especially important is the warning to avoid conversations with a demon. We may ask what is relevant, but anything beyond that is dangerous. He's a liar. The demon is a liar. He will like to confuse us. But he will also mix lies with the truth to attack us. The attack is psychological, Damien. And powerful. So don't listen. Remember that. Do not listen.
Hello, Reagan.
Good morning. How are y'all doing?
I'm a friend of your mother's. I'd like to help you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, then let's introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karras.
You know, I was actually kind of shocked.
If that's true, then you must know my mother's maiden name. What is it?
Oh, I don't, honey.
You speak Latin?
Yes.
Quod nomen mihi est?
Some things are just best left unsaid.
Quod nomen mihi est?
Deus nec felit sed sustus nomus.
Father.
I know he's never been to my home. I've never cooked for him.
Be silent!
Listen, come to my house. I'll cook you a meal.
Be silent!
You know, we don't eat bugs and,
Be silent!
I'm so sorry that you feel that way.
I command you, by the judge of the living and the dead, to depart from the servant of God.
Some things are just best left unsaid.
It's the power of the... It's the power of Christ that compels you.
Hey, y'all.
The power of Christ compels you.
Hey, y'all.
That the power of Christ compels you.
Fuck you.
The power of Christ compels you. The power of Christ compels you.
Hey, y'all.
The power of Christ compels you.
Hey, y'all.
The power of Christ compels you!
These evil corporations that you're referring to...
The power of Christ compels you!
Hey, y'all.
He brought you low by his bloodstained cross. Do not despise my command because you know me to be a sinner.
Yes.
It's God himself who commands you.
Thank you.
You know, weather this cake is better than sex, y'all. Oh, I wish I could tell y'all this joke.
It's alive! It's alive!
Dude, get away from the soundboard. Get him the fuck out of here. Move, man, move! Dude, go. Hurry, get out.
There he is! Hit him again!
Whoa. That was crazy. That wasn't how I wanted to start this whole thing. Good Lord. He told me he was going to be finished earlier this morning. I had no idea how many people were going to show up for this thing. Welcome to number 85, our annual Halloween show. You didn't honestly think that I was going to do this whole year without a Halloween episode, did you? I mean, of course not. It's my favorite episode of the year. And while we don't have a contest of any kind this year, we're still going to do it up Halloween style. And after last year, I threw the show into reverse in last year's Halloween show. And it made things so complicated. Maybe it is a better idea to just kind of play it closer to the bone, play some horror movie audio, maybe just kind of leave it at that. So I'll be sprinkling the show with a little bit of clips from some horror movie, some classic horror movies. Got some great music playing. We'll keep it nice and creepy. Also, listen to this, and this is part of the reason why I'm doing this. Bob Merrick from The Bob Show, he kind of just kind of pushed the issue. I thought, you know, I got to do a show. I'm going to be heading over to Global Voice Studios this weekend to join The Bob Show. So I just had to put together something ahead of that so I can say at the very least I did something for my show in the spirit of Halloween. So don't forget to tune into The Bob Show on Sunday, October 30th. With special guest Nev Campbell from the Scream movie franchise. That's The Bob Show, TheBAUBShow.com. That is going to be a great time. We're going to have a really good time on his show. We're going to be cooking on today's show, so prepare for that. Do a little shopping, maybe ahead of time. We're going to do a classic chicken fricassee with Belgian pale ale or a saison or a golden ale. If you want to use that, just make it pale and make it Belgian. The beer I'm drinking to celebrate Halloween today is Antigoon by Brewerage D. Musketeers. It's the Three Musketeers Brewery. It's literally one of those beers that you want to drink simply by looking at the label. And to be honest, really why I picked this up in the first place, it's a beer that I'm going to be bringing with me to the Bob Show on Sunday. So look for the Antigoon unveiling there as well. The bottom of this bottle, actually the label, illustrates the story of Druin Antigoon, who was a mythical giant who lived in Antwerp, Belgium. The mythical Roman soldier Silvius Brabo, who was like Samson to Goliath. He was an underdog hero who cut the hand off of the giant Antigoon. He tosses the severed hand into the river, as Antigoon had done to many of his own victims. The Brabo fountain in Antwerp shows Brabo throwing the severed hand of Antigoon into the river itself, the Scheldt. So I haven't done this too many times on the show lately. I'm going to open a beer. Usually I have it open before we even do the show. This time, I thought it would be a nice thing to do. Since it's Halloween and we're doing a Halloween beer, open this bad boy right here. Hold on. Oh yeah, it's like that. Oh man, it's a lovely sound. And let's pour. Oh, that's making you thirsty. Oh, yeah. Nice thick head. Nice and pale, like a golden ale. Belgian pale ale, maybe one of my favorite styles ever. Obviously, we've got a thick head here. A really thick head. Some amazing lacing. The smell of this thing. Biscuity, spicy, malty. Classically Belgian. You know, you expect everything from this style. You're going to get it. Smells very good. Smells, you know, every possible smell you're going to get from a golden ale, from an old musty smell from old Belgian beers, which actually works very well considering the label sold me on the beer. You know, it kind of matches that. It's got a very old smell to it. Actually, old beer doesn't sound good when you say it, but it does sound good when you drink it. Okay, it's good. It's actually a little lighter on the tongue than I thought it was going to be. It's a little wild, actually. A good wild. Not like funky wild. A little bit of funk. In a big way, this isn't actually not just a coincidence. It reminds me a lot of Phantom Saison. Phantom Saison tastes very similar to this. It's a wild farmhouse ale. Just not as funky as, you know... Phantom Saison's got some funk in it. And this is not like that. The Phantom Saison, if you don't know, it's the beer with the ghost on it. And that was one of the first two Saisons that actually introduced me to the style, the other one being Saison DuPont. I love that Antigone has a flavor like this. Musty, malty, kind of old world tasting. It matches the beer's character very well. The label, perfect. It's very good. The legacy behind a very old story like this. I mean, seriously, it's a very brutal depiction on the bottle. But it's true to the legend. Things in the medieval ages were very, very tough. I mean, people were tortured, beheaded, brutally massacred on a regular basis. Life was tough. And you didn't have, like, a bunch of 20-somethings with their hands out occupying Wall Street back then. You know, because they would be massacred by thousands of arrows engulfed in flames. I mean, that's how it was back then. Those were the good old days. And this is a good old beer.
The ghosts are moving tonight, restless, hungry. May I introduce myself? I'm Watson Pritchard. In just a minute, I'll show you the only really haunted house in the world. Since it was built a century ago, 7 people, including my brother, have been murdered in it. Since then, I've owned the house. I've only spent one night there, and when they found me in the morning, I was almost dead.
All right, guys, so let's cook something. I know you're going to get a lot of pumpkin recipes around Halloween. All right, you're kind of probably sick of it already. Everything you see has got pumpkin in it. I don't know about you, but in the fall, I like fall dishes. And I don't think you have to have pumpkin in everything. I mean, I don't care if it's Halloween. It doesn't mean you have to be eating pumpkin. So we're going to make a classic chicken fricassee today with pale ale, Belgian pale ale. It's along the lines of a Coq au Vin. It's brighter in flavor, and we're going to be using beer instead of wine because that's how we roll here on the show. It's a braising dish, so it's easy to pull this off and act like it took you hours to prepare when it really didn't. You throw a lot of things into a pot, you let them simmer. When it's done, you thicken the sauce with a little bit of sour cream and some egg, and you serve it up. Very classic, very French, with a Belgian twist. If you're putting together a shopping list, if you want to really make this dish, here's what you're going to need to put this together. Chicken fricassee. You want 2 pounds of bone-in chicken. Now, you can use a whole fryer, you can cut it up, or you can get some thighs, legs, breast pieces, whatever you want to do. If you want to do a fryer, just get some pieces. If you want to go boneless, you can do that. It's up to you. You'll be cooking it a little bit less. Just buy some chicken. All right, you'll need a tablespoon of butter, tablespoon of olive oil, 1 pound of mushrooms that we're going to slice into half-inch thick pieces, 1 onion that we're going to chop, 1 medium-sized leek that we'll also chop, just the white part, not the green, and make sure you clean the leek thoroughly, all right, because leeks tend to have a lot of sand and dirt in them. I mean, they're buried deep into the ground. So if you get a fresh leek, make sure you clean it. 8 ounces of beer. Now, I like lighter-colored beers for this dish. Since we're drinking Antigone, I thought it would be a good idea to go ahead and include it in this dish. Saison works great. Golden ale works great. IPA, pale ale, if you want to do that. Just don't throw a freaking hop bomb in this dish, all right? You're going to get a bitter aftertaste. It's not going to work very well. Something light. Maybe Belgian. Hopefully Belgian. I mean, I think that's kind of the idea I'm going for here. You'll need 2 cups of chicken broth or prepared chicken bouillon. 1/2 cup of sour cream, 1 egg yolk, the fresher the egg, the better, of course, 1/2 teaspoon of grated nutmeg, 2 teaspoons of lemon juice, and 2 teaspoons of fresh tarragon minced. If you can't find fresh tarragon, you can use parsley, or if you want to change the flavor up entirely, you can use thyme or rosemary. Just find something fresh. Oh, and of course, you want some salt and pepper. Okay, I've got my shopping done already. I'm ready to go. I'm going to head into the kitchen, and I'll see you there. right, the first thing we're going to do here, we're going to chop the vegetables. We're going to start with the onion. All right, now don't be a hero. Don't try to Iron Chef this dish, okay? Just chop the onion into small pieces. You don't need a Brenoise. You don't need to evenly cut the pieces into a mince. Just, you know, pieces that are relatively even in size. Okay, we're done with this onion. We're going to put it into a bowl here. And we're going to get to work on the leek. And the same thing is going to go with this leek. You just want to cut it in half. All right, then cut it into half or quarter inch slices. Now make sure you've cleaned this thing, all right? I've said this earlier. These things go deep into the ground in mud. And usually some of that mud's going to still be inside the leek, especially if it's really farm fresh. So make sure you clean it really well. And, you know, you don't want perfect slices here. Just chop it up. All right, we're done with the leek. Put that right into a bowl here. Now we'll get going on those mushrooms. Again, we're not looking for consistency, and it doesn't matter if you want to use it regular button mushrooms, brown mushrooms, whatever mushrooms you want to use. And we don't want consistency. Just cut them into half-inch or quarter-inch pieces. It doesn't matter. These are going to cook quickly and enhance the flavor here. So we're not really looking for any beauty awards with this dish. Okay, we've got all that. All right, now we're going to cut the chicken. Now, if you've purchased, I've already actually cut my chicken up. If you've purchased pieces that are pre-cut, you can skip this step. I've got some pieces here that I've already cut from the fryer. I'm going to cut them into manageable size pieces so everything kind of cooks evenly. You want things to be about the same size. And that brings up another thing. If you're going with boneless, don't mix pieces with bones, all right? Because the boneless pieces take far less time to cook than pieces with bones. So, and also, it's just weird to kind of mix that because they don't know if there's bones in it. It's like mixing in olives, pitless and then pitted olives. So, don't think about it. Just pat the chicken dry here with paper towels. Make sure it's nice and dry. We don't want any moisture on it. So, we're going to be putting it in some oil here. All right, I've got a pan here of actually a deep, heavy bottom pot. And I've got some olive oil, and I'm going to liberally season this chicken with salt and pepper. And I mean liberal, all right? Season these bad boys, okay? Don't be shy. Okay. Now everything's cut up. Let's get this heavy bottom Dutch oven on medium heat here. I've already got the pot. I've got the oil and the butter already melting. Get the olive oil in there. It's hot enough. All right, now we're going to add these chicken pieces in. We're going to start browning them. Okay, now listen, don't crowd the pot. Remember this. You're just a few pieces at a time. You want to add chicken to this. These chicken pieces are cold. And you want to make sure you pat them dry so it's not wet and you don't get all that popping. When you add cold chicken to a pot, it's going to bring the temperature down. We want to keep the temperature high by not trying to brown too many pieces at once. Just get a couple pieces in there, however many will fit, without really lowering the temperature. And we're going to brown these for about 4 minutes. And then we're going to flip those pieces over with our tongs here. And we're going to brown them another 4 minutes. Okay, now when that time is up, we're going to use our tongs to take those pieces out. And put them on a plate or a bowl to rest. And now we'll finish browning the rest of the chicken. Okay, so that chicken's finished. Take that out. Now what we're going to do here, we're going to add our onions and our leeks, and we're going to let them sizzle there for about a minute. Yeah, now you see all that nice black stuff at the bottom? That's good shit. That's called the fond. Not the fond, not the fonds. Hey, that's good shit over there. All that black crap that's mixed in with the fat from the chicken, that's the base of your sauce, and your vegetables are going to pick that up right now. That's what's going to make this. Basically, that's what makes food in restaurants taste so good. I mean, the food you cook at home, the difference between the food they cook in restaurants and the food you cook at home, the fond at the bottom of that pot there, that's what makes their food better than yours, but not on this day. So don't wipe it up. We're going to deglaze this thing in a second. All right. Now, while that's cooking for a minute, I want you to come over here. I'm going to open that beer I told you to buy. In a measuring cup, I want you to pour 8 ounces. All right. In another glass, I want you to pour the rest of that beer. Now, that's for you. God bless the cook. Now, drink. Cheers. All right. Now, let's deglaze this bitch with this beer. Hell yeah. Smell that. Oh, fuck me. I want to go swimming. Stir that up. Now, dig any remaining foam that's stuck in there. Bring that up. Kind of stir it in there. Make sure to rub the bottom with your wooden spoon. We've got the base of this whole thing is right here, and there's no going back. We've got a really good base for the sauce. Okay, now we're going to add the mushrooms. All right, stir those in. Stir that around. You can stir as often as you like right now, by the way. We don't want color to really get on these vegetables. We just want to get them to cook, get wilty, sop up some of that chicken fat. We're going to add a little bit of flour now. Add the flour, stir, keep stirring. You don't want that flour to burn. We'll add the garlic. And keep stirring that. And make sure that flour doesn't stick. It's really hot right now. That flour will brown on you really quick. Alright, now we're going to add the chicken broth. Now we've got that going. Now we're going to add those pieces of chicken right back into the pot. That one there. This one. Okay, now we cover the pot. We turn the heat down to medium low instead of medium. We're going to let it simmer. All right, now that's done. We come over here now. We're going to mince that tarragon. You want to mince this tarragon as small as you can get it. We're going to knead it in a second. So you put it, if you mince it here, really small. Put it in a small bowl, or you can just kind of push it to the side. Now we'll take a glass or aluminum bowl now, and we're going to add the sour cream and add the egg yolk to it. And we'll whisk that up until it's mixed together really nicely. Now we throw in the lemon juice, and then the nutmeg. And then we toss in that minced tarragon that we just minced there. Okay, so about 15 minutes after that pot's been simmering with that chicken in it, we're going to take the chicken pieces out of the pot now. All right, we're going to put them aside in a bowl or on a plate to remove each one. Now, when all that chicken is out of the pot, we're going to add that sour cream mixture right into the stew. And we're going to stir it really nicely here. Now would be a good time, if you want, to taste it. Make sure it's got enough seasoning. If it needs more seasoning, you can kind of add that now. So if you want to add some salt or some pepper, or maybe it needs more, you know, anything. However you want it to taste, now's about the time to do that. Alright, now we'll add the chicken pieces right back into the stew, submerging them, mix all that up, make sure that each piece of the chicken is in there and it's underneath the stew. Get that hold on right there. Alright, we'll put the cover back on the pot and we'll turn the heat off. Alright, so when you're ready to serve this, you just pluck the chicken pieces right out of the pot, plate them, and then pour a little bit more sauce over the chicken. If you want some of the vegetables, get some of the vegetables in there, the mushrooms. And then if you want to serve this over rice or flat noodles or on its own, you can garnish with some fresh parsley across the top if you want to get fancy. And that's it. Chicken fricassee with beer. Fall is here. And summer can kiss our ass.
What she used on my brother and her sister. Hacked them to pieces. We found parts of the bodies all over the house. In places you wouldn't think. If funny thing is the heads have never been found. Hands and feet and things like that. But no heads.
The wife, probably in a rage, threatened her husband with a knife and then, carried away by hysteria, took a swing at him and simply went on from there.
Well, she certainly went on. How many people did she kill, Mr. Pritchard?
Only two. Her husband and her sister. No one else was here.
So there are two loose heads just floating around in here somewhere?
You can hear them at night. They whisper to each other and then cry.
Good evening. I'm your host, Frederick Lauren. Since we're all strangers to each other, let's get acquainted with the drink, shall we?
Mr. Lauren, I advise you to call this party off now. The ghosts are already moving, and that's a bad sign.
Hey, this is getting to be old news now. But this new Sesame Street character, who represents starving children, is kind of touching. It's not only the sign of the times, but I think it's a logical, smart, socially responsible thing for the creators of Sesame Street to actually put together and put on the air. This is from CBS News.
For more than 41 years, those furry friends on Sesame Street have taught kids all about life's lessons, even the tough ones.
When you don't even know whether you're going to have a next meal or not, that can be pretty hard.
7-year-old Lily will soon be the newest Muppet on the block, shedding light on hunger in America. She often goes to bed on an empty stomach. Lily was created for a new primetime special, and Dr. Jeanette Betancourt helped bring her to life.
Lily can talk to children and have their point of view.
In the special, Lily and her family rely on soup kitchens and community gardens to get three meals a day.
And then when I went to the food pantry, my friend Amy was there, and I didn't know Amy was having the same struggles my family was.
According to the Department of Agriculture, more than 50 million Americans are at risk of not being able to afford the food they need. So many are forced to rely on food banks, and an estimated 17 million of them are children.
In New York City, that's 1 in 3 kids in places like the Bronx. We are seeing record numbers of people turning to soup kitchens and food pantries.
It's a sad, sad thing.
8-year-old Alex Mercedes receives free snacks after school from his community pantry.
Sometimes I feel that I don't get enough food.
What is that?
His mother, Jacqueline Manaya, receives free vegetables at the pantry. She's a single parent who works part-time and attends nursing school full-time.
It's you who's carrying the burden.
Well, we do everything as a family. That's what matters the most. I never show any emotion. I just go day by day and that's it. One day it's going to be better.
Sesame Street now hopes Lily's story provides comfort.
Once we started talking, I felt a little better.
And answers, not just for kids, but also for their struggling parents watching too. Begad Shaban, CBS News, New York.
I know we don't want to think about this, but we have to. You know, and this is going to speak to kids. Sesame Street spoke to us when we were children. And kids watching this will speak up. It's a fact. I mean, just about those PSAs they used to do telling kids that it was okay to tell somebody if they were being sexually abused. It's okay for them not to feel ashamed that they're starving, that they're not getting meals. It's not their fault. And I know this isn't a happy topic to talk about, but we're going to have to talk about this. Because this show has grown on topics like this. Just as there are children out there being sexually abused, there are kids out there who aren't getting 3 square meals a day. There are some that maybe get 1. And even that's not enough. I mean, children eat a lot. They have to. They grow every day. It takes a lot of fuel to grow a body. So, of all people to be going hungry, children should really be last on the list. And that's why it's important to support, you know, local food banks. And listen, you can say, well, you know, people shouldn't be having kids if they can't afford to feed them. True. No one is denying that. But the fact of the matter is, they have had those children. And it's their innocent children. And now those children are going hungry. And we've spent a lot of time and a lot of thought in this country about starving kids in Africa and other areas of the world and other countries. And it is tragic. But you don't have to travel to Uganda or Kenya or Somalia to see starving children. Just look around you. The problem exists right here, and we need to do something about it. FeedingAmerica.org, LAFoodBank.org here in Los Angeles, Save Our Strength, or just Google for local food banks in your area. You know, you may not see these starving children, but they're out there. They're around you every day. And it really doesn't take a whole lot to help them.
Please, God, stop this evil spirit from invading my body and my mind. Please, God, stop this evil spirit.
Sorry, I disturbed you. It was wrong.
My mom was very strong-minded. She believed in sinful modern women with short skirts, lipstick, and powder. Should be shunned as much as possible.
What do you think of Central State Hospital?
It's a good place. Good hospital. People treat me nice. Some folks are pretty disturbed, though, you know. My mother was a saint.
So I guess they're making a Top Chef magazine now. Food and Wine is going to publish a 24-page section in its January issue. And it's going to be kind of like an advertorial. You know, you see those areas in a magazine that say advertisement, and it's like 18 pages long. It's kind of like that. And they say if it takes off, that they're going to make a real, you know, push for it. And Top Chef is really making money now. Idro National reported that visitors bureaus of both Dallas and Austin, you know, because they're doing Top Chef in Texas now. Dallas and Austin denied paying money for Top Chef to film in their cities, only to find out later that, according to San Antonio Express News, the San Antonio Convention and Visitors Bureau paid $200,000 for the show to film there, in addition to $400,000 shelled out by the state of Texas. $200,000. And it bought them 8 of the season's 14 episodes. Houston was given the opportunity to pay $120,000 for just one episode, which they declined. Question is it worth that kind of money? A spokeswoman for the governor said the show has the potential to bring $15 million worth of tourism dollars into Texas. Hey, this happens a lot. You see it in sports all the time. Cities want the Super Bowl or the All-Star Game in their city because it brings in tourism dollars. The thing is, the city has to pony up the cash for additional law enforcement, fire, paramedics, traffic control, you know, stuff like that. Then there's cleanup on top of all of that. So we don't see that with something like Top Chef. $200,000? I don't know. That seems light to me compared to what it costs a city for a sporting event, like the Olympics. The question is, how much tourism is 8 episodes of Top Chef going to bring to the city? I guess we'll see. I don't really think I'm going to be covering much of Top Chef, but I thought the story was kind of funny. How a food show can actually, you know, get a city to pony up money to help them, you know, produce the show. And again, they said that they weren't going to tell them what they did with that money. $200,000? That's a lot of cash.
I am standing outside the perimeter of what is turning out to be the most horrific crime scene since Jack the Ripper stalked the streets of London. What police have uncovered reads like this. Words can't describe it. Human skulls used as ornaments. Body parts stuffed in refrigerators. And I can't believe what it says here. A mass grave of decomposing bodies dumped under the crawl space of the house.
Hey, CNN had this coverage of Occupy Wall Street, which, if you can't tell by now, I think Occupy Wall Street's complete bullshit. And if you think it's complete bullshit too, wait till you listen to this. You're going to shit your cage.
This is the supply line right here. This is what it's all about. Occupy Wall Street is about coming together and supporting one another, and we're getting it from around the country, around the world.
Thank you for all you're doing. Your loyal supporters from Oak Park, Michigan.
Best wishes from Alan from Cologne, Germany.
Please accept these humble donations. I am poor and fighting foreclosure, but if you are willing to occupy and keep this message alive, I will support you. Godspeed.
During when the time it was going to rain, we were getting just like thousands of rain ponchos, emergency blankets. We're getting all kinds of winter outdoor gear, canned goods, canned meats, foods of all sorts.
This is all stuff we just got from the last week, because before that, we were just, whatever came to the P.O. box, we just sent to the park. Now we started storing things here, and we are preparing for sustained occupation.
These asshole kids, with their hands out for a freebie, now they're taking food from food banks. Seriously. With the problems that we have in this country, people who can't honestly make ends meet, who are trying to make ends meet, can't do it. These shithead kids are out there protesting and taking food from people who have lost everything and don't have the opportunities that they have to earn a living. What do you want payback for exactly? What did you lose other than access to your daddy's trust fund? I mean, you know who has the right to be out there protesting? The people who actually lost their asses in that financial meltdown. People in their 50s and 60s who were actually, you know, just a few years from retirement and then saw their pensions or 401ks go down the drain. People who actually worked for a living for decades. And look who's out there protesting. Most of them probably haven't done a single hard day's work in their lives. Mommy and daddy paid their way through everything. Drove them to school in a Mercedes or a BMW. Or maybe they drove themselves in those cars. Tennis lessons, social clubs, you name it. Soccer practice. And while you swam in that pool, Paco and Juan did the gardening and their wives cleaned your house. And you sat there and you hated your parents for not understanding how hard life was on you. You never, ever put in a single hard day's work. Not a true one. And if you did, you probably bitched about it like it was Armageddon. And now daddy's money's all dried up because of Wall Street. And you're going to bitch about it because he can no longer afford to make those BMW payments. Or he can't afford to pay for that trip to Paris that he promised you after you graduated. Or pay for your free ride to Harvard. Boo fucking who? I mean, look at this. Look at this and then listen to that Sesame Street audio again and you tell me if I'm overreacting. Imagine the kids who aren't getting fed today because these overprivileged asshole kids out there are taking food that was intended for the less fortunate. When I was in San Francisco, I saw a ton, and I mean a ton, of hippie 20-somethings begging for change on the street, and it made me sick. These were fully capable kids who could work, and they chose not to, and they had no shame about it. Laid on the street with a Starbucks cup in their hands, begging for money. And sometimes if you refuse, they'll scream fuck you at you. Get a job. Get a job, bust your ass for 30 years, pay into retirement, become one of us, then actually lose something. Then you can bitch and moan to Wall Street about being ripped off. Until then, piss off. No one's paying your education, and you shouldn't be taking that food. Quit taking food out of the mouths of people far less fortunate than you. Just shameful.
It's your ancestor, Commander Torre, hanging beneath these very windows. Francesca de Pazzi. On the related subject, I must confess to you, I'm giving very serious thought. To eating your wife. If you tell me what I need to know, Commander Torre, it might be convenient for me to leave Florence without my meal. So I'll ask you the questions and then we'll see, all right? Okay? Oh, you're confused. Well, please don't be confused, because I may have to fillet Signora Patsy after all. Well, shall I answer it? Pronto?
I've gone above you. I've spoken to your section chief. Someday you'll thank me, or you won't. I don't care. You'll be alive. Inspector Patsy?
Is this Clarice? Well, hello, Clarice. I'm afraid I have bad news for you.
Is he dead?
Did you get my note? I hope you like the skin cream. I had it specially made for you.
Is he dead, Dr. Lecter?
Clarice, there is nothing in this world that I would love more than to be able to chat with you. Unfortunately, you've caught me at an awkward moment. Please forgive me. See you around. An old friend. What's it to be? Bows in or bows out? Like Judas. Are you confused? I'll decide for you if you'll permit me. Child.
On the topic of death, there's an interesting article in the New York Times this month about death row meals. And we've talked about this a few times on the show, so I thought it was topical. The question is, if they were going to turn the juice on you tomorrow, and this is kind of the game we play here on the show, if they were going to turn the juice on you tomorrow and you could have whatever you wanted as your last meal, what would you have? Well, last month in Texas, which is a state that kills far more prisoners on death row than any other state, the prison officials said no more. They killed the tradition of special meals for inmates that were facing execution. There was an inmate on death row, and this is what killed it. This guy's name was Lawrence Russell Brewer, and he was an asshole. Requested a meal so large, I don't think that power eater, Kobayashi, the hot dog eating contest guy, there's no way he'd be able to eat this. This dude was an asshole his whole life. And stayed an asshole right up to the time that they gave him the lethal injection. They should have chopped his freaking head off. Listen to this. This guy was 44 years old. He was a 44-year-old white supremacist gang member. All right. He was convicted of chaining a 49-year-old black man to a pickup truck and dragging him along a road until he died. So because he felt so entitled, as his final meal, this dick requested a pound of barbecue with a half loaf of white bread, three fajitas with fixings, a cheese omelet with ground beef, tomatoes, onions, bell peppers, and jalapenos. Two chicken fried steaks smothered in gravy with sliced onions. A triple meat bacon cheeseburger with fixings on the side. I don't know what the hell that means. A large bowl of fried okra, a meat lover's pizza, a pint of vanilla ice cream, a slab of peanut butter fudge with crushed peanuts, and three root beers. Now, they gave him some of the items in smaller portions, and he ate none of it. So the state said, all right, enough's enough. So after the state makes this decision, Brian Price, which is a 60-year-old former inmate who was working as a jailhouse chef, he cooked last meals for 218 prisoners on death row in Huntsville, Texas alone. He offers to prepare the meals for the condemned for free. And the state said, thank you, but no thank you. So this racist cracker prick blows it for everybody. But I'm sure the request got to be way too much. I mean, we think about it. We're joking when we do it. But we're not on death row. Nobody who listens to this show, I hope, would actually murder somebody. You guys wouldn't do that, would you? I know you guys are edgy, but you're not that edgy. Our game's more like, look, I can look into the future, and I can tell you tomorrow, I'm going to choke on a chicken bone. So I'm asking you, what's for dinner tonight? And please hold the chicken, all right? I know you're not going to order chicken. So, according to this article, there were guys requesting things like steak and lobster. And it would force them to get creative in the kitchen because, you know, listen, someone's going to request a steak. They didn't have steak. They didn't have lobster. Someone asked for a steak, they'd use ground beef or something, and he'd try to make it as close to a steak as possible. You know, they'd order lobster, and he'd have this frozen pollock, you know, the fish, the battered fish. He'd remove the breading and he'd slice it up so it looked like a lobster tail. Anything to make them feel like they were eating something they actually wanted, to make them feel special before they died. Now, there's a lot of people out there who feel that prisoners on death row don't deserve that special request. And there are some who feel death row is actually unnecessary altogether. Regardless, it's always one jackass that ruins the fun for everybody.
Now there are nine. There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you.
So years ago, Katrina and I did a haunted tour of Fullerton, where we were living at the time. And there were a lot of restaurants on this tour, and some of them had these stories that they told us about these places that, you know, they were haunted. And it freaked us out a little bit, and a lot of it made sense. Some of the things that happened around the time of the tour, it kind of gave me goosebumps. Because, you know, it's fun to get scared. I know you can poo-poo this all you like, but it's fun to be scared. That's what Halloween is all about. So I wondered if there were other restaurants in Orange County that were haunted. And I started looking around Orange County because I know there had to be other stories about other restaurants all over the place. And not just here. Listen, if you live in an old establishment with a lot of history, I mean, Pennsylvania, I know, is full of that stuff. In the East, it's even worse. The older the place, the more of a chance that there's going to be some kind of a haunting. So I did some research around here, and it turns out that there's this restaurant here in Anaheim called the White House. It's a White House restaurant. It's a very nice restaurant on top of a hill, and it's very prestigious. It's old, it's big. It's got 8 different dining areas and a menu that's got a lot of authentic Italian dishes on it. So I did some research here, and it's interesting what I found. The restaurant actually is inside of a home that was built in 1909, and I'm using this as an example because the White House, there's about 1,000 White Houses out there in the United States, and I'm sure you could find one if you looked hard enough. This place was built by this couple, Dosith and Alberta Gervais, and they had 3 children, Violet, Dorothy, and Gladys. Dosith was born in Illinois and came to Los Angeles to work for Southern Pacific Railroad in 1894, came to Anaheim in 1903, and Alberta Penny was a daughter of an early California pioneer. And the Gervais family lived in the home until 1916, when it was then purchased by Mr. and Mrs. George Waterman. There's a lot of history here, but follow me because there's a lot of stuff that goes on. In 1919, Dr. John Truxaw and his wife Louise bought the home. Truxaw was born in Nebraska in 1883, moved to the area in 1910, and after he and his wife were married in 1913, they raised 8 children in this house, the White House. Dr. Truxaw had a local office where he delivered over 3,500 babies in the area. He was known throughout the area as a kind and generous man who never refused to help those in need. He died in 1952. Carol never married, lived with her mother until she passed away in 1969, and the house was bought by the Stovalls in 1980 that were then renovated, remodeled, and converted into the restaurant, which was then bought by Bruno Serrato that opened in 1981, and he is the current owner. So the restaurant is rumored to be haunted by a young girl, several children, and a woman. Some believe that Dr. Truxaw lost one of his daughters in a tragic car accident in front of the house. As the story goes, the girl was playing in front of the house in the street, and she was struck by a truck. And she was quickly taken upstairs, where she died from the injuries that she sustained from the accident. In addition to the story, Robert Truxaw, at the age of 17, while also playing in the street, was also hit by a car, but did not die. So I guess the Truxaw children had a thing for playing in the street, and maybe back then car horns or brakes were in kind of short supply. Anyway, there were a lot of accidents back then. Anyway, the question is, who are the spirits that exist in the White House restaurant? Some think that it's the Gervais family, the original owners. They also had a child who had died in the house. In addition to that, a member of the second family, the Watermans, also suffered a family tragedy which forced them to leave after only 3 years of living there. In addition to that, one or more members of the Truxaw family, the third owners, another possibility is that there may be spirits representing all 3 families who still remain in this structure, maybe reliving memories of a happier time or something. Of course, until they were run over by cars. This should also serve as a reminder to kids, stay the hell out of the street. I mean, they told us that when we were kids. Maybe that's why. They think the female spirit might be a Gervais Waterman or Truxell wife who walks around the halls of the house, you know, thinking about the happier time she had there. Bruno Serrato, he's the guy who owns the restaurant now. Only person to date who's actually seen a ghost, but can't identify who it is because he doesn't have any pictures. He doesn't know, you know, what the people look like who lived there before. He said there are positive sightings of spirited children there. Voices of children have been heard in the hallways. And psychic investigators have confirmed that at least two youngsters from that time play inside the residence. During one investigation, the chandelier in an upstairs room began swinging and twirling around like someone was hanging on it. Which, you know, kids would do back then. In addition to playing in the street. There are times when the staff would hear the sound of footsteps running back and forth between the upstairs rooms when the area was unoccupied. No one up there, and they heard noises. They're all certain of one thing, they say, that when the house was remodeled into a restaurant, the ghost came out in full force. There are strange noises, unexplained footsteps, items that are moved by unseen hands, all attributed to the spirits that tend to occupy the upstairs rooms. They've got staff that reported hearing footsteps making their way up the stairs back and forth down the hallway. Connects this green room to a blue room. The upper floor, unoccupied, they hear noises. One night, there was a waiter that was working alone on the second floor, putting some stuff away. He watched as a handle on a balcony door suddenly turned and the door opened. And there was no one outside at the time. Reported lights have been known to suddenly dim or go on and off on both floors. These things tend to happen more frequently on the second floor because there's no one up there usually. A waiter was working in the main dining room, ran into what he called a wall of cold energy that prevented him from moving for a few seconds. He said it felt like someone unseen had passed right through him. This area, as it turns out, used to be the living room where the house was a residence. A woman standing behind the bar once reported being pinched by an unseen force as she was pouring wine. A day after that, there was a bruise on her leg. And get this, there was nobody standing anywhere near her at the time this happened. Bruno, the current owner, said that a woman was dining in the restaurant last year. When she took him aside, she told him, unsolicited, mind you, that he had three spirits in the house. She could feel them. One spirit belonged to an elderly woman who frequents the downstairs, very pleasant, totally unsolicited. She came in there to have dinner, happened to be a paranormal expert, told him the place was haunted. Told him this. On top of that, a lot of guests of the restaurant have reported witnessing a lot of the same thing. This same woman, while dining in the downstairs area. The woman said that a beautiful, slim, blonde-haired woman in her mid to late 30s roams the upstairs area along with her 4 or 5-year-old daughter. The mother and daughter appear to be very happy, and they seem to hang around the hallway of the blue room quite often. Bruno, the owner, he said, listen, I've had unusual encounters myself. He was closing the restaurant one night. He said it was really late, and before I was walking out, it sounded like a kid was running upstairs. And it freaked him out because the alarm was on, and if someone would have been upstairs, it would show. So he starts walking up these stairs and notices a bluish light coming from the blue room. Which is, I guess, a coincidence, but still. Never found the cause of the light. Never saw who was responsible for the running sounds. Convinced that it was the spirits. And he knows they're having a good time being there. I looked around on the internet. Turns out, the White House in Anaheim appeared on Food Network's Haunted Restaurants a couple years ago. Where a lot of these tidbits came from. And now they're looking into additional research and doing some paranormal investigation to find out exactly why the restaurant is haunted. I think a lot of times you just don't know. It just happens. And as long as there's not problems, and as long as they don't disturb the guests. But man, I'll tell you, I've had my encounters myself. It's kind of weird. And listen, you can poo-poo this stuff all you like. There's a logical reason for everything, every noise, anything you see. I'm going to tell you something that came completely unsolicited back in June from one of Katrina's co-workers. Before I do this, I want to remind you of a piece of audio that I played last October about a ghost sighting at the Queen Mary right here in Long Beach.
One of our frequent eye reporters says she's really creeped out by something that happened during a visit to the Queen Mary in Long Beach Harbor. Chris Morrow was filming while her husband took photographs. And looking at his shot of the piano, they noticed what looks like a spectral face staring up from the surface. The Queen Mary has a reputation for being haunted, so immediately the discussion turned to ghosts.
I got a reflection of a ghost on the glass top for the piano when I took a picture of it. I don't think it's the Bruce ghost, which is known to be here, but I got one.
So you guys saw the picture. Wait, what do you think? You saw the picture.
Real, yeah.
Bruce,
I'm freaking out. Totally freaking out. I'm so scared right now.
I think it's real.
I can't believe it.
I want him to come back again.
Keep playing.
I really want him to come back.
You saw the picture. What do you think?
I don't know.
I think they just...
No, we watched him take the picture.
We watched him take the picture.
We stood right here.
I just... It was like my fourth or fifth picture or something.
Second time it's happened. But to have a full picture of a face like that, that doesn't happen often. So, obviously he wanted to be here. He wanted to come up and because we get orbs a lot, but we don't. I'm so excited, I can't stop.
Chris Morrow told us she went to the Queen Mary the night before Halloween, hoping to put together a spooky segment for iReport. But she says she never expected to see anything so ghostly.
Okay, so it's June. And Katrina comes home one day after work and tells me that one of her co-workers was out with friends over the weekend having drinks on the Queen Mary, and a friend of theirs was taking pictures. So a couple days later, he downloads the pictures to his computer so he can email some pictures to the group, and one image that he took from the side of the bar showed an image of the little boy standing behind the bar near the tap handles, was looking just off camera, definitely in plain sight, right next to the bartender. Absolutely, beyond the shadow of a doubt, an apparition. He was freaking out. He sent it to everybody. And so I said, can you send it to me? So he sent it to me. I saw it. Holy crap. It was clear as day. I sent it to Spoon from Should I Drink That? So he could see it. He flipped out. So I remembered hearing these stories of children and spirits and a lot of older guests hanging out on that ship. Sir, things like noises, lights dimming, things moving, you can give me a logical explanation for everything. But for some dude using, obviously, a point-and-shoot digital camera with zero Photoshop experience, in case you wondered about that, to serve up an image like this, you gotta admit there's a bit of a possibility. And for all you digital photography geeks out there, I did check the EXIF data. I used this program called JPEG Snoop just to check. And you can tell it was not altered from its original time and date stamp. So that argument, out the window. So I put a picture of this on mylifeasafoodie.com. Check out the image, click on it, and you'll see a larger image that I've zoomed in on the apparition so you can see it clearly. And then you can kind of decide for yourself.
Andy, hi.
Please, thank you so much for coming back.
No problem.
We called Dr. Avery, but he's gone.
Yes, he's out of the country. He'll be back.
We need your help.
This is overpowering.
It's getting worse.
Yes, it certainly doesn't like that I'm here, and I cannot help you.
What?
In fact, I've got to get out of here. This thing is very aggravated, the fact that I'm here.
Wait, everybody calm down. We need your help.
Well, I've got to tell you, I am not the person to help you in this situation. This is not my area of expertise. No, I think I'm doing more harm being here than any good. Yes, I really have got to leave.
Okay, I'm going to get the hell out of here before I scare the shit out of myself. Thanks for taking the time to listen. Thanks to CNN and CBS for the audio. Apologies to fans of Paula Deen, but not really. Music in this episode... Yes, there was. You know the drill. Don't forget to join me on The Bob Show on Sunday, October 30th. Should be a great time. TheBAUBShow.com. I'm bringing some beers, and I'm bringing some dude food. Until next time, my name is Phil. This has been my life as a foodie. Happy Halloween, everybody.
You're dressed in all in black, from your front to your back, and all your evil ways, they seem to go on for days, and as a matter of fact, you got one more than a
Edward Gein had lived most of his life in a farmhouse with his mother and his brother Henry outside of Plainfield, Wisconsin. His father died when Ed was a child. Bible-pounding Mother Gein always warned her sons that all women were sinful. Just stay on the farm. Ed considered her a saint. As an adult, Ed's brother Henry started to disagree with this view of mother. He told the now-grown Ed that he was too attached to their mother, a mama's boy. Henry Gein died shortly after that, during a forest fire. Ed was the last person to see him alive. Mother Gein died after a series of strokes in 1945. Ed sealed off her bedroom and the parlor as a weird shrine, living only in his kitchen and his bedroom, immersing himself in books about anatomy, Nazi atrocities, South Sea Island cannibals, and true crime stories. A government subsidy meant he no longer had to tend the farm. Occasionally, he hired himself out to his neighbors. Some of Plainfield's 700 other residents called him Weird Ed. He would give them a funny smile at odd times, but nobody paid much attention to the harmless 5'5" farmer. According to Ed, he convinced another local farmhand named Gus to help him with some work. That work was grave robbing. Old Gus and Ed dug up the bodies of women and carried them back to Ed's farmhouse. Ed told his friend only that he was doing experiments. Few people ever entered this lonely farmhouse. Brave boys would try to peer into the house because Ed said he kept shrunken heads in there. Ed always chased trespassers off his land. The house became unimaginably filthy with layer upon layer of waste, slop, and unidentifiable clutter. Cheap pictures of Jesus on one wall and a mask of human skin on another. Comic books and volumes on embalming. Children's toys and human bones. One night in 1954, Ed walked into a saloon in nearby Pine Grove, deserted except for the owner, Mary Hogan, who physically resembled Ed's mother, but whose body attitude reflected Ed's image of a scarlet woman. Ed shot her with a .22, packed the 51-year-old woman onto a sled and carted her back home. Ed continued his lonely life, unmolested by outsiders or sanity. Occasionally, local families would ask him to babysit. He was always there to help out. In November 1957, Ed hung around Warden's Hardware Store in Plainfield. Beatrice Warden was a buxom woman whose shape reminded Ed of his mother. Mrs. Warden's son, Frank, was deputy sheriff and unofficial fire chief. Eddie mentioned in passing that he'd have to buy antifreeze for his truck. On the first day of hunting season, Plainfield's men were out chasing deer. When Frank Warden came back to his mother's store, he found her cash register missing. So was his mother. There was a blood stain on the floor and a receipt for antifreeze. The death of Beatrice Warden appeared to be utterly senseless murder. The sheriff drove out to the Gein farm, finding the shed unlocked. Hanging from the rafters, upside down, was the headless body of Beatrice Warden, slit open like a butchered animal. Gein quietly went into custody, and the full horror of his house came to light. Investigators prowled through the rooms of the filthy Gein home. On the stove was a fresh human heart in a pot, ready to be cooked and eaten. The tops of skulls were hollowed out, used for drinking bowls like the ancient Vikings. Human organs were kept in the icebox. Furniture had been reupholstered with human skin. In a box were Ed Gein's collection of female sex organs, cut from the corpses he had dug up. There were 9 face masks peeled from the heads of the dead. One was identified as Mary Hogan. Vests and leggings sewn together from the skin of cadavers were found. As near as anyone could reckon, there were a total of 15 bodies. In custody, Ed Gein quietly admitted to his ghoulish habits. He only vaguely remembered killing Beatrice Warden and Mary Hogan, and indignantly resented the implication that he had stolen Warden's cash register. He merely wanted to see how it worked. Plainfield suddenly became infamous. Reporters, scavengers, and tourists flocked to the town that boasted a real live ghoul, a man who dug up corpses, ate their organs, and dressed in handmade vests of human skin under the light of the moon. One entrepreneur bought Gein's truck and exhibited it throughout the Midwest for morbid curiosity seekers. Another man planned to turn the Gein farm into a permanent museum of horrors, charging admission for the privilege of being revolted. The farmhouse mysteriously caught fire. Local authorities took their time to get to the scene. That wasn't a surprise. The fire chief was Deputy Sheriff Frank Warden, who had seen his mother's body hanging like a gutted deer in Ed Gein's farmhouse. Ed Gein was put under observation at the Wisconsin State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Over the years, psychiatrists questioned Gein like a prized trophy. One test had the patient explain familiar sayings. When the doctor said, "A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush," Ed Gein chuckled and said, "If you have a bird in your hand and you squeeze it too hard, you might kill it." The doctors decided Eddie wasn't quite ready for the outside world. He died of old age in 1984. The nurses all agreed that he seemed like a nice, harmless little man.